Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, good Sunday morning. Good Gulf Coast Sunday morning. We got a lot to talk about this morning. Look forward to it. Getting great pictures of loquats. It's that time. It's that time to pick loquats, is it not? It's beautiful pictures of gardens. Greg's got great pictures of his gardens he's already sent to me. Really great to see gardens being so productive. And, you know, in part, I think the productivity of our gardens and the beauty of our gardens, the roses in my yard look about as pretty as they've ever looked in spring. And it's probably because we were very close to being in a drought. David has ruined that for us, as he likes to remind us, by watering his lawn, in which case we got a ton of rain. So we're back. We're back to being old Mobile, back to being a little bit wet again. We're probably out of this drought for the time being, but April and May, you know, it's that time of year when these kinds of droughts can happen, and they're not the worst things in the world. They're not the worst things in the world because they actually it actually results in much better produce when it doesn't rain quite as much, and much prettier roses and much nicer flowers. It's been a nice spring. It's been a good spring. We're about to run out of spring, though, because our first 80-degree days are beginning to, we're going to begin seeing them here very soon. And once that starts, it's tough on a lot of those spring plants, but means your tomatoes are not far off a good time of year. Hey, you know what else is going to happen this time of year? It hasn't started growing yet because it was a little dry, but with this rain, it's going to start growing now. You know what I'm talking about. It's that lawn thing. It's that grass thing. So we've got a, it's been dormant mostly. Most of our warm season grasses have been dormant for most of the winter now. November, December, January, February, March, they're pretty dormant. They don't look like much. They don't have to get mowed that much unless you've got weeds coming up in them. Good time to mow them. And the drought has kept them from growing a whole lot, too. And we're kind of looking forward to that season when it is never-ending mowing. And you think, and there's something to worry about every week. You know, no matter what you do, there's a problem in your yard. There's going to be a, you know, something. There's a weed that you can't identify that you feel like is going to take over your St. Augustine. There's some fungal disease that's taking over. There's some bug that you're worried about. It's just freaky. It's this summer grass season, and then you're out there mowing it during the hottest part of the year. And some days you're out there mowing, and you're thinking, you know, nobody even goes in the yard in July, and I'm out here mowing this grass all the time. What's the deal? So let's talk about what the perfect grass would be. Can we talk about it? Because I've been thinking about it, and it's an interesting subject. If you didn't like all this falderol that we have to go through every summer with your warm season grasses, your St. Augustine, your centipedes, your zoysias, What would be the perfect grass? You know, the perfect grass would be a grass that just looks incredibly green, not like centipede, which has this terrible pale green that you almost can't fix. But something that has this incredible green all the time. Something that, boy, wouldn't it be great if you didn't have to have sod? Because with, you know, almost all the grasses we grow, all these warm season grasses, we have to have sod. We have to put in sod. So if something goes wrong, we got to go to the sod maker, and we got to get sod to put it in because there's not another easy way to do it. Warm season grasses don't. But what if you could start it from seed? What if it were really easy to start from seed? We talked last week about centipede grass. Man, you could get centipede seed, but it ain't easy. It ain't easy at all. It's kind of really hard. But what if it were really easy to start from seed? And what if you never had to use a herbicide or a pesticide on it? What if it were just beside the point that you never had that problem? You never had that problem. at all, and you never had to worry about it at all. And what if it didn't take a lot of fertilizer? What if it were pretty adaptable to different types of soil? What if you never, maybe you only had to irrigate it once when you put the seed in? What if that were, can you imagine? And what if it were really tough to foot traffic? This is incredible. Can you imagine a grass that did all these things? That was really great with foot traffic, that you couldn't stomp it out. St. Augustine just tears up. Centipede tears up. What if there were a grass that did everything right, that was just the kind of grass, all you had to do was mow it, and you didn't even have to mow it that much? What if there were a grass like this? It'll just look great. That complemented the seasons when we spent the most time in the yard. That was green when we spent time in the yard. We have that grass. It's called ryegrass. It's our winter grasses. And you know, it's a funny thing, because we want to think like the rest of the country. Because the rest of the country, they want a grass that's green in July, because that's the only time they go out, because it's too cold the rest of the year. So they want a grass that's green in June, July, and August. July is the one season, and I think you should. I think I encourage you to do so. But I guarantee you don't have parties on the lawn in July, because it's going to rain in the middle of the day. And it's too hot, and you got all kind of complaints. I like going outside in July, but you don't. What if you had a lawn that matched our seasons when we go out? Winter rye, there it is. Perfect. 6 months of the year, winter rye is one of the best, is the best grass you could possibly have. It is the best grass we could possibly have on the Gulf Coast. Our problem is that we need to turn the world upside down. We think that summer grasses, because we want to think like we live in Boston, we want to think like we live in Michigan, we want to think like we don't live in Mobile. We think that summer grasses are the most important grass. But what if our winter grasses were our most important lawn? What if we built our lawn around winter rather than building it around summer? Just a thought. Just a thought. You know, I'm actually doing that in several places, and it works. It really works. We did it. We talked about it at Mobile Botanical Gardens, and we started the process. I'm not out there controlling it now, but we started that process. One of the things, and we're suggesting this in several places, don't worry about the summer grass. Don't try to sod it with summer grass. Just use rye. The rye grass, you're going to sow it in October. It's going to look incredible all winter long while the camellias are blooming. It's going to stand up to traffic. It's going to look great while the azaleas are out and blooming. It's going to be this stunning green color that's almost unimaginable. And then in late April, mid to late April, it's going to all die down. Boom, it's gone. There it is. So what do you do then? Well, there's lots of things you can do then. And one of the things we were doing at Mobile Botanical Gardens was putting straw on the paths, so that the areas, we had these big wide paths through the camellias and pools, and in those areas, you can just put straw down. It's so simple. Did it at several gardens I created. Where we had the gardens terraced, we had wide paths between the terrace and other pools. I didn't want to go through the trouble of putting sod down. I didn't want to think about all of the things I was going to have to do to maintain that sod, particularly with dogs. So what do? It's very simple. You sow ryegrass, and then when summer comes along, you can either sow wheat straw or you can put pine straw down. There's some other possibilities as well. It's an interesting thought, thinking about where you are, thinking about how to turn the world so that it reflects Mobile living rather than living in Michigan. You know, this is it. I've been working with you on these summer grasses for so long, but we should be honest. Maybe we should just forget about the summer grasses. You know, let's think about these cool season grasses and maximizing. It's the one lawn we're actually happy with all year long. You could oversow, but there's problems to that. We'll talk about that when we come back. Hey, I've got some, we'll talk about lawn. We're going to talk about vegetables. I'm thinking about trellising. It's that time of year we got to do it. And yeah, there's some issues with ryegrass, but we're talking about how to fix that. It's a very simple thing to do. It's much easier to fix the problems with ryegrass than to fix the problems with warm season grass. Rusty, I got your tree figured out. Great pictures from David on his Melaton. We're going to be back. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Oh, welcome back. It's Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Yes, so you understand that when we talk about planting these cool season ryegrasses, I warn you that they always die back in April. Greg, they'll tolerate more than 72 degrees. You know, probably it's these first 80 degree days that kind of say to the ryegrass, it's done. It's over with. And so it's going to be mid-April, maybe late April some years, when that ryegrass starts dying back pretty good. And then you've got to figure out what to do. It's the same with warm season grasses too, isn't it? They basically are going to go dormant in winter, and they look brown, and we tolerate that. We tolerate that for those warm season grasses. We kind of have to do the same with the cool season grasses, except you will need a ground cover, and those ground covers can be pretty simple. So in the area around your beds, you know, if you've got a vegetable bed, Greg, I'm thinking about your vegetable bed. I'm thinking about other people who've got gardens. You know how the warm season grasses invade those spaces? That can be a big problem. It can be a real annoyance. So in the area around those spaces, that's a great place for ryegrass. Just have put the ryegrass in winter, let that take over, and then straw that up really nicely in summer so that you don't have those invading grasses coming into your vegetable bed. It's a great way to think about it. But you can also think about extending that to larger parts of your yard. And that's what I'm doing. You know, I actually have some St. Augustine. It's doing okay. It's got a few little problems here and there. Every warm season grass does. And I could leave it to grow, but you know, it takes a lot of mowing. It takes a lot of mowing. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take those areas of the yard. And they're not a quarter acre. They're small areas. They're the nice areas that I used to wrestle my brother in, theoretically. And that we used to lay around in. They're really pretty. And during summer, what we're going to do when we lay around in the grass less is I'm going to take those live oak leaves and just lay them out. Just make a nice mulch area. Make it really pretty. You're not going to notice it because the vegetable garden is so big. Everything has grown up around it. It's going to be fine. And then we're going to really feature that yard in winter when it's a lot easier. It's a different way of thinking about things. Oh, it's hard. It's the world upside down. But you know, the Gulf Coast is the best. We are at our best on the Gulf Coast when we turn the rest of the world upside down. And think about it that way because that's what we do best. There it is. Something to think about, something. So Rusty, I want to get to Rusty real quick. Rusty sent me some pictures. Rusty, this is an incredible tree that you have there. It tells me a lot about your forest and what your forest used to be. That is a white cedar. What we call on the Gulf Coast, some people on the Gulf Coast call it juniper. But it's not red cedar, it's white cedar. Camassiparis. You're in a part of Mississippi where there may be two kinds of white cedar. It's very important to recognize that Mississippi had two varieties of white cedar. One was Mrs. Henry's white cedar, and the other is the more like the northern white cedar. Very important part of Mississippi. These forests used to be really extensive, and they were very important because juniper wood as everyone knows, who builds boats, was the great boat building wood of the Gulf Coast. Very rot resistant, very beautiful wood, made incredible boats. All of our old boats were made out of juniper, white cedar. And that's what we're looking at. Once you said those needle leaves, it helped me out a lot. Thank you. It's a beautiful white cedar. Gosh, what a great specimen of white cedar. You know, it's let's talk about that, Rusty. We're going to talk about that a little later in the show. Tell me a little bit more as to whether there are other trees and that are like that, and we'll talk about what to do about that, because that's a very, very important tree. Very important tree. So we got a caller. George, I'm listening.
Yes, sir. I'd like to read a brief article. It goes along with something you talked about, a week or so ago.
Okay.
Now, I got this article from Southern Living, April 2019. It's the Grumpy Gardener, our garden expert.
Yeah,
Flaky crepe myrtle. My crepe myrtles are a grayish-like growth on the branches and trunk. Is this some type of fungus? The trees are getting new leaves now and appear to be growing, but I am worried that they will die. Okay, the other paragraph. The growth is called lichium, L-I-C-H-E-M, comma, and is all over my crepe myrtle, too. Now, here's the thing. It says it is harmless and completely natural, so there's no need to worry or do anything. And I wanted to say good morning, Mr. Bill Finch, and to the tax man over there in Daphne.
Yeah, so that's lichen, L-I-C-H-E-N, lichen, is the plant, and it's a cross between an algae.
L-I-C-H-E-N, yes.
Yeah, it's a cross between an algae and it's a complicated organism, but it actually is not harmful to plants if what we're looking at is lichen, and a lot of crepe myrtles that don't have a lot of leaves on them or that are fairly young will get lichen growing on the trunk, entirely harmless, and it feels feathery and soft to the touch. It's a neat little thing, and it is harmless. There is one other thing that we talked about, and this is what you heard me talking about, something else entirely.
Okay.
There is a scale insect that's attacking crepe myrtles, and it's getting really bad, and the Grumpy Gardener has written about that scale as well. It is attacking crepe myrtles in a big way. I got a report that it is now showing up in Mobile County. I've heard many reports from Baldwin County that it is just covering trees in large portions of Baldwin County. So this scale, which is a very different thing, it might have a grayish appearance at times, but it's going to look black and like your tree is covered with this weird black mold or soot or it's almost burned black. It's this scale, and it is pretty serious, and it is going to make a big difference in whether people choose to grow crepe myrtles. And the thing I've tried to emphasize is that when we love trees, we need to remember that we can't overplant them. It's good to know the name of more than one tree. So we are having now, after years and years of insisting that the only thing we plant were dogwoods, we got into big trouble. We can't grow dogwoods anymore. And after years and years of insisting that the only thing we can grow are crepe myrtles, we're about to get into serious trouble. I think it's going to be very hard. I think people are going to quit growing crepe myrtles.
Yard full of crepe myrtles.
It'll get there.
Okay.
That's the unfortunate. It's just now coming to Mobile.
Thank you very much.
All right, good. So it's a big thing. So we have to be careful. It's going to happen with live oaks as well. And I keep, listen, We love live oaks. I love live oaks. I love the way they make Mobile look. They're very special to us. I have a real fascination with live oaks and where they grow and in their native habitats. But we've overplanted live oaks, and it's beginning to catch up with all of us, all across the Gulf Coast, all across the range of live oaks, from Texas back to Florida. We're getting these diseases that are moving towards us. So we're going to have to plant other things besides live oaks, and we're going to have to be really smart about it. I just talked to a landscape group about it yesterday, it's good. It's good. It's a good thing to think about. It is, and it's a good reminder, George, that lichen is a harmless plant, and it can get on crepe myrtles at times. But some of the other diseases, we got to worry about them a little bit more. Hey, so Greg, has Greg forgiven me yet for saying that ryegrass could be a great grass for us? Yes, Greg, you're right. It does go dormant. So do other grasses. And it's just that we turn the season upside down. And it's a hard thing to think about. But, increasingly I think it makes sense to think about using ryegrass in many areas where we've been insistent on warm season grasses. You do have to have something to cover the ground during summer as well. But I think there are ways of dealing with that just to prevent erosion. You know, it really matches to really feature that winter grass is sort of the idea I'm thinking about. Let's feature the winter grass, not the summer grass, because the summer grass is the thing that gives us the most problem. Yes, David, I agree St. Augustine is one of the better summer grasses, but it has problems too. So it's an interesting thing, turning the world upside down and thinking about what it means. Hey, give us a call this morning, 251-343-0106.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. So I have a question here. It's a good question. It's an interesting question from Tony. He saw a palm in South Florida, somewhere in Florida, and wondered if it could grow here. They're very different growing climates. And certainly in South Florida, there are a number of palms that can be grown there that can't be grown as well here along the Gulf Coast, in the northern Gulf Coast. It's hard for me to tell on that picture. I'd have to look at it a little closer exactly what we're looking at. I would be cautious about it. There are some palms that look somewhat like that, that it may be possible to grow along Fowl River and in some of the warmer places. And in this case, I think the pygmy date palm may have a very similar appearance. Pygmy date palm, Phoenix robilinii. It is marginally hardy in our area. I think it might do okay. It actually, the great thing about this date palm is, unlike a lot of date palms, it actually tolerates humidity really well. And so that's a nice thing about it. I think if I were going to grow this palm, I would put it in a very protected place. On the south side of a building, close to a building like they have it there, it would be very good there. Let the building do the protection. And that might actually be a good palm. Phoenix robilinii. There's also another palm, another pygmy date palm, that's a small date palm. These are not the big date palms. These are small date palms. I'll have to think of the name of it, that might be a little bit hardier, though it doesn't like the humidity as much. So it's kind of an interesting trade-off. But probably that's a Phoenix palm, Tony. And there are some Phoenix palms we do very well that have that size and that shape. Good. Got a caller. Charlie, I'm listening. Who's calling in? Gary, I'm listening. What's up?
Hey, Bill. I was looking on Facebook, and I saw, and I don't know if this is more of an ad or a factual situation. It recommended for hunters to grow Dunston chestnuts instead of planting oaks because they typically start bearing after 3 to 5 years. They bear every year versus, you know, a lot of your oaks bear every 1, 2, or 3 years. And then the deer prefer the fruit because it doesn't have tannin in it. And they get more protein. It had a bunch of reasons. They're less disease. They're more disease tolerant and more drought tolerant and a number of other things. Does that make sense to you?
No.
Now,
let me tell you why.
Ranges in the United States where you should, you know, these do well.
Right, right. Dunston.
And we're in the Black Belt, and the Black Belt was a range where they supposedly do well.
Well, yeah, they do okay. They do okay in the Black Belt. They're not going to like those limestone soils a lot. But let's talk about deer real quickly. If deer had the kind of narrow view of plants that we have, they would starve to death. Deer are eating lots of things in the woods all year long. So the question is, why did we focus on acorns? I'm not sure why. It really doesn't, because it's a very narrow window in the year. And chestnuts are a very narrow window. I mean, we're basically talking 2 or 3 weeks when those chestnuts are good and edible. And you've got 52 weeks in a year that what's the purpose here? If you want to make healthy deer, if you want to have big deer, you want to have lots of protein for those deer, you need more than just one plant at one time of year. And so we tend to focus on the wrong thing when we focus on something that sheds its fruit at one time of year. If you want to attract deer to a place, if that's the goal, if you want to attract deer, there is nothing in the world that will attract deer better than persimmons. It will out-attract deer that quicker than anything else in the woods. If it's Japanese persimmons, just good old American persimmons, I have seen deer beat a path through kudzu. They wouldn't eat the kudzu, which they can actually eat. The kudzu would say, okay, well, the kudzu's good for us, but we want those persimmons. And I have seen them just beat these paths through kudzu fields to get to the persimmons. They love persimmons. So it's an interesting thing. There are people who are trying to market to deer hunters. And in order to market to deer hunters, you have to really oversimplify what it is that deer eat and what it is they want. And to say, yes, I think they'll eat those chestnuts, no, I don't think they're going to do that well in the prairies at all, because a lot of those American chestnuts don't like limey soils at all. They like well-drained, deep, fertile, sandier clay soils. But it's not that I'm telling you not to plant it. I'm just saying don't have high expectations for how it's going to affect the deer population. Persimmons, if you want to attract deer, persimmons are the thing. If you want to feed deer all year, think about what's in the woods. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of different kinds of plants that deer eat, and there are a lot of them. And I'd love to talk about it. Sean and I are going to have to get on the show one day and talk about it. Did I I mean, am I barking up the wrong tree here?
You know, we do fall planting and spring summer planting, and we've got a lot of honeysuckle and a lot of good browse, a lot of green or blackbriar and that kind of stuff. And but you know, hunters are always looking for additional nutrition for their deer and turkey.
Yeah, so you know it was the big thing, and you know you may have had the unfortunate pleasure of hearing me complain about the Japanese oaks that we plant in the woods, which is crazy. I mean, we're the center of oak diversity basically in the temperate world, and Alabama is, and we go to Japan, which has very few oaks, and they're not particularly good oaks, and we get an oak over there, Quercus acutissima, which people here call sawtooth oak, and we plant that sawtooth oak as if it makes a big effect on deer. It has very little effect, I think, on deer in terms of weight or anything else, but it was something that they sold people, and it was easy enough to plant, so they went out and did it. And I think it's a big mistake. So, I wouldn't emphasize the chestnut thing. It's an okay thing. It's a fine thing. I wouldn't recommend it for prairie soils, for limestone soils in the Black Belt. But it's an okay thing, but it's not going to make a big impact on deer in terms of weight gain over the year.
Uh-huh. We planted a number of sawtooth oaks many years ago, but they did pretty good actually, but they dropped the nut, and of course I assume the deer gets a benefit out of it, but they dropped the fruit real early relative to some of the other oaks, so it's not during the season when the deer are actually eating the fruit.
Yeah, that's right, and so it's a well. That's what I'm saying. I mean, they grow fine. They don't live long. They have some problems in terms of excluding everything else, which is my problem with them, is that all the other forage then gets excluded anywhere you plant that tree because it has very low limbs.
Yeah,
and it's a problem grower and a problem in the woods. You know, a good fire would take care of that. and fire, if you want the best forage for deer, there is nothing that compares to fire. It makes a huge difference.
Yeah. We do control burns, to the extent we can. Sometimes we're limited by the, weather windows and that kind of thing, but you can really tell the benefit of those.
Oh, it makes a huge difference in terms of both not only the variety of plants that are available throughout the year, but in the protein content, in the mineral content that is in those plants, it changes everything. Fire, it's huge, and it's the best friend for every type of game. You know, maybe we'll even remember that we used to hunt quail, and quail. What a great part of our hunting tradition here in the South, and we've lost it. Because we've lost this understanding of how the woods worked, and we've lost this thing, we've lost the fire. Yeah. Turkey are going to love the fire too, by the way.
Yeah.
So we got this deer subject. Let's we got another caller online. I'm listening, Cade. I'm listening. What's up?
Yeah. Real quick, I heard y'all talking about them old deer again, and I'm just going to make it really simple. If you had to eat cornbread all year. Okay, like a deer gets to eat everything he wants all year. But then here comes October, and here comes them sweet old pears, and here comes them sweet old persimmons. A deer, you can't fight it. You got to go and get him some of them sweets. Been eating that old roughage all year, and, man, you can exist. But, man, when them sweets come around, I got to get me two plates and take it to go.
Well, they do like the fruits. They do like the soft fruits. I agree.
I've seen a deer stand on their hind legs one time crossing over a dirt road, and I stopped, and they stopped and got up on that pear tree, and I didn't know it was a pear tree, and I'm like, what are they doing? Like, they're dancing. And so after they ate and went on, I come up and stopped on that tree. And I've been by that road 100 times and never knew there was a pear tree there. And here they are coming and trying to reach up and get them bottom pears. They won't eat them off the ground because of them yellow jackets. The ones still hanging on the tree, they were trying to reach up there and get. And
yeah, that's interesting.
I said, man, they was wanting them pears.
Yeah, well, and the nice thing about persimmons, too, and pears as well, is they yeah. do have a long season that they're available. They don't all drop at once, and and that's kind of nice. You know, I appreciate what you're saying about the cornbread. I'll just make this argument. Actually, you know, there are hundreds of different kinds of plants that they're eating on all year, and I think they like those
all
plants.
All year long, browsing on everything.
Browsing on everything, and it's good. It's really good for them, and I think they like that stuff, and it's really has good nutrition, probably better nutrition all in all than the persimmons and the pears. But there is no question that, boy, do they go for the persimmons and pears if you're trying to draw deer in. There's just no question. Much more than corn. It's really an interesting thing. Well, that was fun. We're going to be back talking about other things, but we'll talk about your deer too. Stay tuned.
Is not an iris or a wild rose, but a little flower of which I'll tell, known as Brave Coney Bell.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Ooh, John, look at those pretty glads. You know, I'm sorry, amaryllis. I know that picture is going to make one person very, very happy, those picture of amaryllis. Hey, Taxman, how are your amaryllis looking?
They're blooming good. I'm cross-pollinating some more of them. There's some real unusual colors I have. But look, Bill, the testimonial the fella called in about the deer and the pear, that was real, real interesting. Now, let me say this. I have friends up at Spanish Fort and Baymanette Basin. Man, the deer love those persimmons. That is really, really good. And I got a hunter that lives next door to me. He's got a lot of land up there in North Baldwin, and he really takes care of his persimmon trees just to feed the deer. So, look, this is a good, good story this morning, so I'll let you go.
Yeah. All right. Well, good deal. So, yeah, it is interesting, isn't it, about you know, it's always a good idea anytime you're doing something. You know, I always say this. Why am I doing this? What am I trying to accomplish here? It really helps. And one of the big problems we have when we plant things, or when we prune things, I say it with pruning. It's a classic case. Somebody says, "Well, how do I prune?" And I say, "Well, first tell me why you're pruning." Because why you're pruning, if you can tell me why you're pruning, and if you can't tell me why you're pruning, then I can't tell you how to prune. And it's the same way with planting things. Tell me why, what you hope to accomplish for the deer by planting that thing and with that chestnut. And if it's to feed the deer, well, it's kind of a minor thing. You know, if you're just trying to build protein or those chestnuts, they're okay. They're fine. It's not going to have a huge impact on your deer population at all. Because there's not enough of them. It's only for a small part of the year. It's just not going to have a big impact. If you're talking about drawing deer in, that's another story. And whether you think that's appropriate or not, it does. And they can certainly draw deer in during the hunting season. Whether you can make use of that is another question altogether. But people certainly use corn, and persimmons are much more potent than corn. I can tell you, there are some questions about whether you want to draw deer into a concentrated feeding station. And if you haven't heard of deer wasting disease, then that's one of those questions. Do we want to do that? Are persimmons safer as a draw-in than corn? I don't know. But these are things we have to ask. Why are we doing this? Why are we doing it? It's an interesting question. Well, listen, lots of good things. I want to address this white cedar question. Rusty, I hadn't heard back from you, but it's exciting to me to see white cedars. White cedars are these incredible things. They were so much a part of Gulf Coast tradition. The great boats of the Gulf Coast, the great sailboats, the great fishing boats, the punt boats, they were all made out of white cedar, juniper wood. Juniper, we called it, on the Gulf Coast, just to make it confusing. Incredible wood, incredible forest, and a forest that we've forgotten about. You know, it struck me that while we were all trying to preserve the live oak that turned out to be not a very old live oak at all, there in the Inspiration Oak down there along Weeks Bay, we were all trying, the same people trying to preserve, were cutting down white cedar left and right. And the white cedar was far more important to Gulf Coast history, far more important to Gulf Coast ecosystems than that 80-year-old live oak. It's a tree we forgot, white cedar. What a beautiful tree. What a wonderful tree. It's, you know, and Greg is right. Greg sent me a note that Mr. Stouter probably used juniper, and I think he did. I don't know if he ever used it for planking, but I think he did use it for parts of the boat, for some of the ribs and other things. But traditional boat builders who did planking and who built boats, it was juniper wood they were using. Very, very important part of that. So it's an interesting thing. Rusty, I would love to talk with you, Rusty, if you ever get a chance, about how do we preserve these old forests? Because we lost them for a very particular reason, and it had to do with that thing called fire. And a lack of fire, but also overuse. There are ways that you can get this forest back, and it's a beautiful forest. I love white cedar forest where they occur. They're really beautiful. They're really handsome. It would be great to create little patches where those white cedars can come in, and I think it'd be fun, Rusty, to talk about how to do that. So give me a call sometime. Let's talk about it. And we'll figure it out. Tara, I'm listening. What's up?
Hey, grass question. I'm sorry, I'm getting some feedback. Are you hearing me?
I'm hearing you fine.
Oh, okay. I'm surrounded by neighbors who like the golf course kind of a thing, and that's just fine with me because I'm kind of the opposite. I don't like grass, you know, like because of the maintenance and the lack of wildlife and all that kind of stuff. So I do more of a self-composting oak leaf that's been gradually, I've let it grow in for a number of years now. Monkey grass is what we call it here, right? Is it Mondo grass? Is that what the name is?
It all depends. I think it's fair to call it monkey grass. There are two types of monkey grass, or three types. And there are the ones that tend to stay small and grow in clumps are often called Mondo grass. The one that tends to spread a little more freely is not usually called Mondo grass, but it's all common names, and you can call anything you want. Nobody can put you in jail for calling a plant the wrong name. So people call plants the wrong name.
I did have a policeman come by one year, quite some time ago, and this was when it was growing, and it does grow out towards the curb. And he was going, "Your grass is more than six inches long." You know, it's like, and I went, "Sir, it's a decorative grass." You know, now
yeah,
I don't grow it that long everywhere. And the question I'm getting to is, because I want it to spread and to continue to spread, because particularly underneath oak trees, it is the one grass that will grow. And it is a beautiful green, and it's a beautiful contrast with the areas that I use. I use leaves. I rake them over to make pathways because I have dogs that pound everything, you know. They compost the leaves all the better with me. Now, last year, I finally figured out that if I took the berries when they bloom at the end of the summer, early fall, instead of, you know, just leaving them where they were, since I've got it established enough, I started, you know, picking a few handfuls here and there and flinging them to the areas that I want it to grow. My question now is, because it's coming back out like all the other grasses, when is the time, the optimal time to mow it? Should I mow it now, or should I just continue to wait because it's just now putting out the new growth?
Tara, hold on just a second, because we only got a brief time. I'm going to tell you, if I'm going to mow that, I always mow it just before it puts on new growth, so that the new growth hides those brown tips. And so, you know, it's a really good time when it's actively growing this time of year. Go ahead and mow it just before it starts that new growth. It's probably not too late to do it. I would do it again. You know, June is another good time to do it, just before that summer growth takes off. So it really is about hiding those brown tips that sometimes develop when you mow it. Now we have to take a big break.